So we shall begin. And it's good to see such a large turnout, actually. You should see what the other lectures are like. So this is the week where you send in the outlines for your essays, right? And you email them to your seminar leader. Yes, sir?
I was asking about that outline. In the question, we couldn't lie when there was a V in the essay question.
Right.
Well, what does that mean? It's like it's got two meanings, and I feel like both meanings can make sense in the question. So I compare with one regard to.
Yeah.
I'm not saying which one is it and vis a vis.
Okay, can you give me the question? I don't have the question with me. I wasn't expected to be ambushed here. So the question here is...
For the actual essay.
Yeah, I know.
The wording is a vis-a-vis.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
In relation to?
In relation to is what it means.
Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Okay, what else did you think it meant?
It can also be compared.
And what do you take the difference between the two to be?
Well, comparing would mean that you'd have to give one argument and then contrast it with another one, whereas in regards to, you could just focus on one line of the...
Yeah, you're supposed to focus on the thinker that of the four, right? But we need to know that... But what's important is that you need to specify what is the position you're coming from with regard to whatever fair and just conception of the law, right? So you have to have that specified. But most of the essay is going to be about a critique of one of those four people. Right? So you're critiquing them, but I have to know the standpoint you're coming from. That's why it's vis-a-vis.
Okay.
You see what I mean? So the ideal way to write this essay would be to tell me what is your conception, you know, what does a fair and just conception of the law mean? And then you're going to pick one of these four guys and say how it falls short. It's in the question. Look, when you're being asked, you got these four guys, right? The essay is about one of those four guys. But what about it? What is it that you're supposed to be considering? Well, you're basically supposed to be critiquing them. Critiquing them in relation to what? To what you consider to be a fair and just conception of the law.
So one of the positions that we've gone through, perhaps?
Whatever you choose. You could pick natural law theory, you could be legal realism. I mean, we have a whole menu of possibilities in this module. You can even invent your own if you want, okay? But the point is, I need to know where you're coming from. This is the point. Here's what I don't want you to do, is I don't want you just to tell me everything that's wrong with the theorist. Right? Because for each of these, you know, because all four theorists are theorists that people have written a lot about and have said a lot of critical things about them. And what I don't want is a laundry list of complaints about these theorists. Right? I want it with respect to a particular conception, right, of fair and just conception of the law, which you choose.
How long do you think we should use? How many words? Well,
to get your conception out, how long before you get into... You don't have to, I mean, it doesn't have to be a lot. I mean, it has to be just as much as going to be necessary for you to make your critique.
Okay. So say if you just said, I believe natural law theory is a fair and just conception of the law.
Yeah, but you know, you just can't do that in one sentence. Natural law theory can mean a lot of different things. I need to know which conception of natural law theory is going to be relevant for critiquing the theorist.
Okay.
Right? But the thing is, you're aiming it at the theorist. Right. This is why the vis-a-vis is actually the word. I mean, right? This exercise has two parts. You might say one part is for you to think about what do you take to be a fair and just conception of the law, at least one that you're willing to work with, right? And then you're going to critique one of these four guys by that. That's the basic idea. Okay. And you can and while you have to choose one of those four guys, the fair and just conception of the law is up to you. Right? I don't even care if you believe in the particular fair and just conception of the law that you choose, because you may find, especially since you're lawyers, that you may find that the easiest conception to work with is not necessarily the one you believe. Right? I think you can understand why that might be the case. Right? Because if you believe in one, you might end up having a kind of overcomplicated view about it. Right? And that might make it hard for you to actually engage the question. Because we don't want you to spend the whole essay writing about your conception. Okay? You kind of get what we're talking about here, right? In any case, this is the reason why you write this little draft, or whatever you want to call it, outline. So we have a chance, we have a chance to look at it, and if there are any problems, we can catch them before it starts to count for something. Okay? Any more questions about this? I'm trying to make it interesting. Not only interesting for you, but interesting for me. I got to read these things. Right? So this is... And God knows there are a lot of, exam questions are generally, they're forced to be dull. But with essays, we can get a little exciting. Okay, so are there any other questions about this? Okay, so critical legal studies. It's interesting. In the past week, I was in the United States, and Scalia, you familiar with him? One of the associate justices of the U.S. Supreme Court died. And now there's this whole big battle about whether Obama will be able to replace him before he leaves office. Obama's going to be leaving office in less than a year. And Scalia was a very important guy because he was one of the great opponents of judicial activism, right? He is one of the law's conservatives. In fact, probably the most intellectually accomplished member of the U.S. Supreme Court who's on that side of the issue, on the conservative side of the issue, which means that he understands what the law says very narrowly. So he doesn't... He believes that, that the founding fathers and people who draft legislation actually mean the law to apply in a relatively restricted way. They do not, generally speaking, consider the law to be something that can be interpreted expansively, which is what judicial activists typically do, right? In a lot of key issues involving rights of minorities and other sort of civil liberty style issues, Scalia was always with the conservative side. And because the U.S. Supreme Court is basically, it's a 9-person court, and the reason being so that there wouldn't be any stalemates, right? If you have an odd number, right, it's going to, it's always going to be 5-4, at worst, right? And this is one reason why there's a certain amount of urgency, and generally speaking from the Constitution standpoint, that these judges ought to be replaced quickly, even if the president who would nominate it is not going to be around very long, okay? Because there's a whole load of cases coming up before the Supreme Court where, in fact, there is quite a lot of potential for judicial activism if the court were so inclined. And so if Scalia is replaced by a more liberal, progressive judge, as Obama is inclined to do, one would think, then this tips the balance from 5-4 to 4-5, right? And so then you get a completely different reading of how the court works. And of course, the U.S. Supreme Court is an appointment for life, so whoever gets put on there, and even if this person is in their 50s, which is a kind of a normal age to be appointed, that person could be around, as Scalia was, for 30 years. Okay, so it's a very important kind of decision. But the thing that was interesting was immediately the issue got drawn on the question of judicial activism, right? So this is the issue about what legal realism was all about, was about judicial activism and being very upfront that this is what the law is for. The law is, as it were, a means, an instrument for making policy. And in a way that implies that it might actually override traditional considerations, even traditional considerations of the law, right? Because if you're living in a new world, you need to act in a new way. Now, this issue of judicial activism, as it turns out, I heard this phrase again yesterday. Why? Because I was listening to Boris Johnson announce that he is going to be voting for Brexit. Right? He's going to support the Brexit campaign. And when he was doing his little speech out there in front of his house, when he stepped out, I don't know if you saw this, one of the things that he said and he objected to about Brussels was its judicial activism of the European Court. He said that. He made that very phrase, right? And he said, there's these courts just imposing all these kinds of rules and regulations, and that, Britain doesn't have sovereignty over these matters. Now, as it turns out, of course, if you look at the kinds of things the European Court has been imposing on Britain, they often have to do with things like civil rights, workers' rights, things of this kind that otherwise might not make it through British Parliament, right? Or otherwise with great difficulty. Okay, so that was a little part of the issue that Boris left out, namely that while it is true that the European courts can override the sovereignty of British courts, nevertheless, if you look at the situations in which they do this, it is generally on behalf of the people. Okay? And so this is, again, another case, and I think this one, you know, as we see the arguments for remaining or leaving the European Union start to develop over the next 4 months, this is going to be on the table very much, the issue of the activism, because it's quite clear that the European Court of Justice understands itself as an activist court, because part of what it's trying to do is to create a uniform standard of justice across all of Europe, presupposing, right, and not unreasonably, that there are different standards in Europe in the different countries. And not all countries protect all the same things, and there needs to be a kind of uniformity of the law. So that then suggests judicial activism. Okay, so this whole legal realism thing that we've been dealing with is very, very much a live issue, very much in the minds of people as they make decisions. Not only in matters relating to the law strictly, but also with regard to these larger political issues like our membership in the European Union. Now, so we're going to now turn to a movement that at one level you might say is kind of politically more or less on the same side as legal realism, that is to say on the left, a kind of left movement within the law, but kind of a bit more... how should we say, skeptical about what exactly the law can do, especially understood as an instrument of power, okay? Because one of the things that I think makes the distinction between legal realism and, let's say, positivism, and this is what, you know, so if you've read Roberto Unger's book on the critical legal studies movement, you'll see that Unger begins by talking about this thing he calls formalism, right? Formalism is like positivism for our purposes, okay? And so, you know, positivism and realism are in a way very, very much opposed in a very clear kind of way, because legal positivism, and Unger stresses this aspect, right, kind of operates on the assumption that law has a kind of objectivity to it. Right, so we've got this law as a system, right, and it has a kind of logical structure, right, and judges in a way are, you know, interpreting and discovering it, but it's kind of a real thing, right? The law is a real thing. It's a thing that we create, but it has a kind of its own independent reality, right? The law is its own sphere. And this is what Unger is calling formalism. And then legal realism, you might say, takes a completely opposite tack. Now, the way Unger characterizes legal realism in the book is interesting, because he calls it skepticism. He sees legal realists as being skeptical about the law. Now, why would one put it this way? Well, because it is true, legal realism is skeptical about the law as a fact, and the law as objectivity, right? It's skeptical about that. It doesn't believe that there's an independent sphere of the law. It doesn't believe in this kind of pure theory of law conception that Kelsen had, right? Right? Legal realism clearly doesn't believe that, right? Doesn't believe that sense of law exists, actually, right? I mean, if you read, again, think about Oliver Wendell Holmes, for example, right? I mean, law is basically, a kind of exercise of power, right? It's an exercise of power. It's an exercise of power that is done by judges, legislators, you know, and lawyers are involved, and that's what it boils down to. But, you know, what the legal realists believe, and again, this is very clear in Holmes, is this idea that, in a sense, the law is a kind of instrument, right? So you can get things done with it, right? It's not a perfect instrument, it's fallible, which means that laws have to be seen as hypotheses. Right, where you see, okay, if we put this law, does this actually decrease crime or does it raise crime? If it raises crime, then we have to change the law, right? But in any case, it is an instrument by which you exert power in the society, basically to get the society to be the way you want it to be. Right? So it's very, has a very kind of positive, policy-oriented goal. And in some of that respect, it's a very political kind of thing. But it's, of course, I mean, and this is the point that makes the kind of, you know, the whole legal aspect of this different from ordinary politics, is, of course, you're thinking about, if you're a legal realist, your conception of politics is at the kind of ultimate level. What are the ultimate goals for this society? What is a good society? That is what the laws should be aiming for, kind of the big picture, the long term. It's not about partisan politics, but rather it's about these larger kinds of issues that are about the way in which people lead their lives in the society. Okay? Now, the problem with this view, now here is where critical legal studies comes in. You know, I say that legal realism is skeptical of the kind of objectivity of positivism. Well, critical legal studies is skeptical of, you might say, the efficacy of legal realism, right? In other words, a guy like Oliver Wendell Holmes, and this goes for most of these guys, really do seem to think that the law can, in some way, once you get it right, you know, reorient and change the society in some kind of definitive fashion. In other words, it's a kind of clear, you know, exercise of power where you try to do something and you can do it if you've got the power and the authority to do it, and then it happens. Okay? And of course, that kind of view of the law, right, this kind of exercise of power, right, is exactly the notion of the law that conservatives like Scalia are against. But the interesting thing from the legal, critical legal studies standpoint is that both Scalia and the legal realists believe the law actually has this power, right? The difference is Scalia says the law should not be exercising it or be kind of do so very sparingly, whereas the legal realist actually wants to go in there and use the full force of law to make the society better. But both of them agree that the power works. Critical legal studies is basically skeptical of this way of thinking about power. Okay? And I think that's kind of where, you know, that's where critical... So critical legal studies in this respect, okay? Again, I want to... When people talk about critical legal studies, they often talk about it as being a kind of postmodern movement. Okay? And I'm sure you've run across this word postmodern, postmodernist. Okay? And one of the things about postmodernism that's relevant to critical legal studies that makes it seem like a kind of postmodernist movement is that critical legal studies is profoundly skeptical about any kind of grand narrative that the law tells about itself. Whether that grand narrative is the kind of formalist narrative that somebody like Kelsen talks about, or the kind of big power narrative that the legal realists talk about. Right? They're skeptical of both. And they're generally skeptical, and so they're also skeptical of people like Scalia who talk about the law has to act with restraint. Because that too presupposes the same conception. It's just taking a different view on it. So what the critical legal studies movement basically has, you might say, is a kind of deconstructed approach to the law. Okay? In other words, you cannot judge the law by what the law says about itself, but you have to look at what it actually does in practice. Right? You got to cut through the verbiage. And you got to see what it looks like on the ground. Because, you know, even somebody like Holmes, right, if you look at what his, you know, because at one level, Holmes seems like a very, you know, down-to-earth guy in the way he talks about the law. But if you think about it, he's really imagining the way the law works as something like an experiment in a laboratory, where society is the laboratory, right? So you're trying to minimize crime. So you come up with these laws, right, that try to minimize crime. And you're sort of trying to double think what the criminals are thinking and trying to counteract that and all of this kind of stuff. But that way of thinking about the law, where some guy sitting on a bench can kind of, you know, understand what's happening in a neighborhood through some kind of, what, telescopic lens, right? That is a fiction, right? I mean, that's not real. That's not really how the law works, right? So even if Oliver Wendell Holmes, you know, creates this kind of law, you know, that is meant to get rid of crime, right? There's a lot of stages after he makes his pronouncement, right? He writes his judgment, but then someone's got to implement it, right? It's got to move from the courtroom into the local districts, right? We've got police, we have got other attorneys, we've got other lower courts where challenges could be made to the law, right? All kinds of issues, right? If you think about how how do you go from Oliver Wendell Holmes to what happened to your street felon, right? There's a lot of stuff in between. And you see, that's what critical legal studies wants us to pay attention to, right? So it isn't that, you know, some great judge, you know, manages to hurl a thunderbolt and crime is solved. It's not like that, right? It's rather a whole lot of intricate, interlocking processes. And what Unger is arguing is that in all of these instances, all these different parts of this process by which the law is implemented and administered, there's wiggle room, right? That's basically what he's saying, right? That there isn't a kind of determinism going on here, but rather there's lots of room to maneuver all along the way. So the fact that the judge issues a verdict and says a certain thing is going to happen, right, that doesn't necessarily determine anything by itself. Right, you have to see how people interpret it, how they apply it, whether it gets challenged. You have to move to all these different situations. And so part of what Unger stresses, and this was very much central to the whole critical legal studies doctrine, was what he called destabilization rights. Okay, and what destabilization rights basically amount to is a kind of recognition, and this is where it goes back to the idea of understanding the law in a deconstructed state, that law does not apply itself. The law may be very clear on paper, right? And Holmes, for example, you know, always said, you know, the law ought to be kind of written as an imperative to do something, right? He thought that, you know, that judges ought to be writing in plain language, making directives, being clear, right? But no matter how clear you are on paper, right, that can be interpreted many different ways in practice, depending on who's applying it, where it's being applied, what are the circumstances, what other things are at play. And so that is, when you deconstruct the law, that is kind of what you're doing, right? You're sort of seeing the fact that really, no matter how clear it seems, it isn't that clear, especially when we talk about the level of practice. So there's wiggle room, right? There's wiggle room here. And what Unger argues, and I think I certainly mentioned this to my seminar group, and I think it's worth mentioning overall, right, is Unger teaches at Harvard University, which is the law school with, the kind of prestige law school for corporate lawyers. Constitutional lawyers in the U.S. study at Yale, but the corporate lawyers study at Harvard. And the thing about corporation law is it is the land of loopholes, right? Now, what are loopholes? Loopholes, you know, are examples of lawyers thinking in terms of wiggle room, right? That's what loopholes are about this wiggle room. Now, what Unger is saying, okay, is that actually, why should the rich guys have all the fun, basically, right? Why is it that loopholes are only available to rich people? Because those loopholes are actually part of the law. Loopholes are not invented by lawyers. Loopholes are a natural consequence of the porous nature of legal language. Again, going back to the deconstruction point, legal language is open and indeterminate in very fundamental kinds of ways, which allow for many different interpretations and many different angles to be played on it. That's just the way the language is. That is not something, you know, that only corporation lawyers have access to. In principle, everyone could have access to it. Every kind of litigant can have access to this. And once you do make this kind of something that's universally available, this kind of understanding of the law, you get destabilization rights. Now, this is really important from the standpoint of people's attitude toward the legal process. Because again, think about it. You know, a corporation lawyer working for a big multinational, they are very confident people, right? These are guys who know how to play their destabilization rights to the max. The law does not intimidate them. They see it as a game, right? And they figure they're going to get something out of it. But now, supposing you're a poor person, right? Someone who cannot afford a lawyer, let alone a good lawyer, right? And you're beholden to public legal services, okay? Your attitude toward the law is you think no matter, you know, if you get brought to a courtroom, you're screwed, right? You think it's overdetermined. You think because of whatever background you come from or however, you know, that you're just going to be damned. And you just got to hope the mercy of the court bails you out and you get a good judge. This is very often the attitude of poor people. And why do they have this attitude? It's because they misunderstand the law. They think the law is much more deterministic than it really is. The rich people know this. Why can't the poor people know this? Okay? And so these are the destabilization rights. And a lot of the things that you see in this critical legal studies movement, in terms of the kind of conception of the law as being sort of plastic and porous and all of this kind of stuff, these are understandings of the law that I would say that rich people have had forever. Okay? This is why they're not afraid of the law. Okay? Whereas poor people, on the other hand, tend to have over-objectified notions of the law. Okay? I'm not saying these people have read Kelsen or anything. That's not what I'm saying. But they tend to think of the law in these kind of very objectified ways. Or, you know, at best they think of it kind of in the way the legal realist wants you to think about the law, this heavy hand of power. But actually there's more to play for. Right? And this is what the critical... And see, from the critical legal studies standpoint, it is by having this more plastic and porous conception of the law that you can... This is actually the way in which you can foster a democratic society. Because remember, right... If you think about, you know, how do you get democracy? Let's think of the various legal theories we've been looking at. If you're Kelsen, democracy basically means everyone's covered equally under the law. So the law's there, it's in black and white, it's there for everyone to see, and it covers everyone equally. That is democracy. And that is one sense, right? Everybody's equally covered under the law. Law applies to everyone. That's one sense. Legal realists, right? How do you get democracy? Well, the legal realist realizes that the law is not necessarily applied equitably under all circumstances. So what happens is you need some kind of heroic judge or legislator coming in and giving democracy to the people through the law. Right? So I was talking about last time about busing, integrating black and white kids in schools in the 1960s, right? That is the law coming down hard, making democracy happen. In spite of what the people may want. Okay? But now, what Unger is suggesting under critical legal studies movement is that the way you get democracy, right, is by actually people coming to understand the law in a way that empowers them. Right? So this then becomes a message for people. Not just a message for judges and lawyers and legislators, but also for people who are brought to trial. Okay? Ordinary citizens. Right? And this is the thing that for Unger, if people understood this the law in this more deconstructed sense, then you'd actually have a much freer society. And people would not feel the law as being oppressive or unfair, but see it in a more, you know, in a more open, even maybe game-like fashion. Right? Where they could where you know it is kind of seen as normal that one, in a sense, plays the system. Okay? And this is, I do think that if you take this idea to heart, it's quite radical. It's quite a radical way of looking at things. Because at one level you might say, God, this is an incredibly cynical view of the law. But on the other hand, it's actually quite empowering. Right? Because the law then doesn't come across as this kind of other that dominates you. Okay? And, you know, with regard to what judges and legislators should do. You know, Unger's view, and here I think this part of Unger's doctrine brings him a little closer to the legal realist sensibility. He talks about what he calls a deviationism. Okay? And what deviationism means is if you operate on the assumption that the law does not determine the way social reality is, that the law is just language, and the language can be applied in many different ways, then there is reason to think that under any legal circumstance, the law is probably not being applied correctly in some sense. Right? In other words, there's some kind of deviation between the law and the way it's applied. And see, what this does, as far as Unger is concerned, is it gives a kind of presumption in favor of a certain kind of activism, right? Namely, that we should not assume that there is some, you know, ideal sense in which the law is already being applied properly, and that somehow if we extend the law one way or another way, we're going to be distorting its purpose. No, what you should presume instead is that there is a kind of uneven fit between the law and the reality. And so the whole idea that you might, you know, extend the application of the law one way or another, it should be expected, should be normal. Nobody should sweat over this, right? And so this kind of doctrine is in a way a response to somebody like Scalia. Because one of the ways in which these conservatives get mileage is by imagining that there is some ideal original way of applying the law. Right? And so this is why you want to know, what did the legislators think when they were drafting this law? And this then somehow gives you a sense of the domain of application for the law. And that if you try to move the law farther beyond that, then you're in some sense violating the spirit of the law. Right? This is the way conservatives think about these matters. So the conservatives, in other words, have a very kind of tight view about the relationship between the law and the domain of application, right, which can be inferred by studying what the legislators had in mind. But Unger, because he's got this more kind of deconstructed view of the relationship between language and the world, believes there is no such thing as a perfect fit between the law and the world. So there's always room for expansion, right? There's always room for the law to move. The judges should not, in some sense, feel, right, that they are violating the spirit of the law by extending the law into a new precedent, right? I mean, and so, you know, this is kind of, you might say, tipping the balance, right, in favor of a kind of legal realism without overtly, you know, arguing for a kind of, you know, the sort of strong sense of activism that would actually have the judges and legislators, you know, kind of develop whole policies to remake the nation. Right, but it does give the bias in favor of extending the law from its normal mode of operation. Okay, now critical legal studies in the 1980s, which was when it was extremely popular in the mid 1980s, was a really big, almost like a fad in American law schools. In the recent, let's say, over the past 10 or 15 years, I don't think it's quite so prominent anymore, though a lot of its ideas have moved into things like critical race theory and some parts of feminist legal theory. So it has had the impact in those areas. But one of the things that critical legal studies was criticized for very early was that it wasn't clear whether this kind of way of understanding the law actually leaves you with the law as a body of knowledge. Okay? Because look at it this way. It's quite clear that with somebody like Kelsen in legal positivism, law is a body of knowledge, right? Law is this objective fact that's there. It's there to be studied, right? To understand, to organize, right? It's there. It's got a certain facticity to it. Now, legal realism, you might say, also thinks about the law as a body of knowledge, though it may be said that the law becomes a branch of social science in a sense, right? Because the law is being used as an instrument for improving society. So you can, you know, as it were, you could study the way in which different laws have different effects in different domains, which ones work, which ones don't work. You could do comparative studies. And that kind of, that's a science of the law, and it looks a bit like a social science. So it's a different kind of science from the kind of science that Kelsen is talking about, which looks more like logic maybe, right? We're talking about something that looks a bit more like social science, but it's still a body of knowledge. Question for critical legal studies is there really a body of knowledge to be made of this? Okay? Or is it, you know, because it is talking about deconstructing the law and basically seeing that the law, you know, the relationship between legal language and legal reality is not a close fit at all and is really pretty much determined by circumstance, and that's why things like destabilization work, that is there something? Is there something to get at, right? Because one might argue that if you were to take critical legal studies seriously, what you would end up with is basically, you might say, a kind of set of advice, you know, like rhetorical tricks or devices, right, to enable you to maximize your advantage in a legal situation, right? That there's a sense in which that's what destabilization rights would allow you to do. In other words, in various circumstances, there are various sorts of moves that you might make, right? And so you, in a sense, start to think about yourself perhaps more as your own lawyer, right? And can that be considered a body of knowledge, or is that just a kind of set of practice, you know, a sort of set of practices that are developed through experience, right? Is it something you can codify, right? Because for the law, at the end of the day, right, all the claims to law as a body of knowledge, whether we're talking about positivism or realism or natural law theory for that matter, has to do with the codification. But here we're talking about stuff that is so devolved to the local settings of particular courtrooms where particular actions are being taken by particular people, that it's not clear that you can actually put this together in any kind of systematic fashion, right? Because, you know, Unger's point, again and again, is that every legal situation is open. There is always everything to play for. When you go to trial, you do not know in advance who's going to win and who's going to lose, right? That's why the trial is worth having. A trial is always worth having. Okay, but the point is, can you get a body of knowledge out of this? And I think the general feeling, and this is why I think critical legal studies never really took off, you know, has not really survived so well, is that it is seen, at the end of the day, as primarily just critical, right? It isn't seen as a sufficiently positive movement in its own right to actually develop its own body of law. You know, so for example, when you look at the kind of work that you see in critical race theory or some of the feminist legal theory, what gives those theories kind of character of being a body of knowledge is actually the particular subject matter that they're focused on, race, gender, right? And that then gives it the kind of, you might say, substance to it. But critical legal studies in this respect is a little too abstract for that. By the way, have any of you ever seen Unger? He has a lot of videos on YouTube. Have you ever watched any of them? No? No one's seen? You should check him out. Okay, he's a very righteous man, and he does these very good kind of small 5 to 10 minute clips. And one of the things that I think comes across very strongly when you see him, because he's talking about all kinds of issues, about the future of democracy and the nature of markets, he talks about everything, is that he really has this very radical belief in the openness of the human condition, right? That nothing is determined, okay? And in fact, one way he talks about this in the book is that humans are context-transcendent creatures. Yeah, you're shaking your head. What does he mean? Right? In other words, that whatever context you happen to be in at the moment, that can never fully capture who you are or what you are. You're always more than your situation. Okay? And he sees, I don't know if you know much about him, but you know, he was a minister for education in Brazil for a while. You know, he took a little hiatus off of being a professor at Harvard and went down to Brazil under the government of Cardoso in the 1990s, I believe, and was minister for education there, and was seen as a kind of a very inspirational figure, actually, because he had this kind of very hopeful message of the openness of the human condition, and that the and that he believes, and I think, you know, that the thing that in a sense holds people back the most is their self-understanding as being overdetermined. And the law, unfortunately, has contributed to that. Okay? Because the law gets seen as a source of constraint on people. Now, do people have questions about this? Does this kind of vision move you guys? Because I've been teaching this since I started my... When I started my career, this was kind of in its heyday. It was in its peak. But over the last 30 years, things have declined markedly in terms of the fortunes. Does this resonate with you in any way, this kind of vision? Of this kind of deconstructed notion of the law as and the openness? Well, I mean, maybe some of you are actually writing to criticize Unger in your papers, so some of you may have answers already in your pocket. No? Doesn't do anything for you? Well, okay, you'll have time to think about it, but the thing I want to, you know, I want you to think about this is, you know, for the seminar question this week, we're going to be comparing this to legal realism in more detail. But if you think about where we're going now next week with human rights, okay, human rights actually gets us back into natural law country, okay, in the sense that human rights as an internationally binding doctrine, right, on the basis of which, you know, all kinds of major political actions can be taken, is based on an incredibly objectified notion of what is, you know, fit for a human being. Right? So in other words, the kind of metaphysical position that the ideas of human rights come from is actually radically different from the critical legal studies movement. Right? The critical legal studies movement, right, in a way, think, you know, sees human beings as creatures who kind of make it up as they go along. That's where the freedom comes from. Okay? So Unger likes to talk about his way of theorizing as constructivist, right? You construct social reality. He's very much of that kind. But when we talk about human rights and the discourses surrounding that next week, right, the conception of the human that's involved is much closer in spirit to what natural law theory provides, in that it is seen as something objective. Right? That human beings are entitled to these things as human beings. And so then the question, and of course we think about human rights as very much an empowering thing for human beings. Right? It's good that human beings have human rights. But then there is a question, and it's interesting, is how does this kind of approach to the law, critical legal studies, how does that relate to human rights? They seem to be really different in the way they orient themselves, right? I just put this on the table because I think, you know, if this, because this view presents itself as being very emancipatory, very liberatory, and I think you could sort of see why, but it goes very much against the spirit in which these kinds of higher order notions of human rights have been presented, which have equally been seen as empowering of people. Does anyone have any remarks about that? Because that's kind of where we're going to be shifting gears starting next week. No, you sure? No comment? This is because it's kind of an interesting problem. No? Going once? Twice? Okay. Well, look. You know, send me or whoever is your seminar leader the formative essay or outline by the end of this week, Friday. You can wait till Friday to do it. and you will get some feedback on this before the end of the term. And that's pretty much how it goes. Okay? Yes, sir.
Can I see you, like,
after this? I'm taking a call after this. Can you email me and we can maybe set up something?
Or, okay, sure.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, guys. Go in peace.
Thank you.